You are now listening to The Scheist Podcast, when millions of opinions just aren't enough.
Hello, hello, hello. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Scheist Podcast and for being here for the new episode of This Week at the Movies. Kristen and I got a few more under our belts as we talk about The Legend of Ochi, Sacramento, Warfare, and The Woman in the Yard. We also take a look at some movie gossip / movie news, the state of movie theaters, and we take a look ahead at what's coming out for the release weekend of April 25th, 2025. It's This Week at the Movies.
Oh, you're making this musical now.
Almost. I was, like, kind of there. I wasn't fully committed to it.
That's fair. You gotta commit or not.
I know. Half measures.
I like the half measure, though.
Okay. We'll get there eventually. It'll be a full-on musical. It'll just be singing reviews of every movie.
You will be. I won't be.
Why is it gotta be me?
Because you're singing and I'm not.
Only because I've chosen to.
And I have chosen not to.
Welcome back, everybody. Haven't you missed this?
Of course.
I think the answer is no for most people.
Why? We're fine.
We are. I agree. The people just got to spread the word. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Share it.
Share it. Yeah. Share it around. If you like this show, if you like listening to us chat about movies, the idea is to, you know, give like a cursory review, but not do a super deep dive. So that way people who have not maybe seen these movies yet can make a decision on whether or not they want to.
Yeah, but I kind of like the deep dive because then we don't have to like tiptoe around spoilers.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, if you're listening to this, just keep in mind that we do, we're conscious of the fact that we're not trying to ruin the movies for people who have not seen them, but we also want to be able to talk about them in a way that is
not cryptic,
worthwhile and not cryptic, you know.
We want it to be spoiler light.
Yeah, diet spoilers. I like that.
Fine.
Spoiler light. It's okay.
Okay.
Either way works.
What did we start with this week?
Well, if we dial it all the way back, I think the first one we saw was probably Sacramento?
No.
No?
Mystery Movie Monday.
Oh, that's right. AMC Screen Unseen. Did you ever request your money back for that?
No, I wasn't really going to do it. Okay.
Well, we saw The Legend of Ochi.
Yes.
Which had released.
It's already been released.
It had released in limited release the weekend prior to the Monday mystery movie. So
I would have requested my money back or our money back if we had seen it over the weekend, because we did talk about it.
We did.
So it was quite possible we would have. You were looking at movie times.
I was looking at movie times. This is true.
And they advertise it as a never before seen feature film.
Which people had probably seen it.
Could have and probably had. So yeah, it was just a little bitter.
Okay.
Did
that shape your opinion of the movie? Were your bitters boiling as you watched?
Possibly, but I don't think entirely. I just set myself up for disappointment because I was really hoping it was Lilo and Stitch. But then I even said to you, like, in hindsight, I should have known better. Disney wouldn't let that happen. Disney needs the big release weekend, so there's no way. It could have been Lilo and Stitch, but I was just really excited and wanted it to be Lilo and Stitch.
I mean, it's still like a young girl and a cute little creature.
Yeah, but it's just like,
it's not Hawaii. It's like,
yeah, it's just not my
Nordic.
Yeah, it's not my favorite way of storytelling. It wasn't bad. I don't say I dislike it or that I didn't like it, or I would say don't go see it. It's just not my preferred, especially for a kid movie. I feel like it's just not my preferred way of storytelling. That's it.
Did you not grow up with dark fantasy movies for kids? Like,
do you not know my childhood upbringing?
I do, but like Neverending Story?
I mean, I loved Neverending Story. I did watch that quite a lot, but it also terrified me as a kid.
As it's supposed to. And yeah. I feel like this is a movie that sort of exists within a similar framework. But I would say, you know, like Willow is one of these movies. Trying to think. Legend, of course.
I mean, I grew up with mostly Disney animation movies.
Okay, so yeah, not exactly.
I mean, and those are dark if you think about it, obviously. Yeah. But as a kid, you don't realize how dark it is. It's more so the parents understand the darkness.
Because it's like, you know, what, Coraline would probably...
But I feel like we weren't kids when Coraline came out.
We weren't. That's fair. Princess Bride, though.
I didn't see Princess Bride as a kid.
Okay. Dark Crystal.
I don't even know what that is.
Return to Oz, also terrifying.
Wizard of Oz scared the crap out of me.
Yeah, and I loved Wizard of Oz.
So did I.
So I think...
So no, I guess that wasn't my genre as a kid.
So for me, watching this, I felt it was very much at home with the kind of movies that really were impactful for me as kids' movies when I was young. I mean, my favorite kids' book growing up was, I think it's called The Oddkins. It's by Dean Koontz, who's a famous horror writer. He's like Stephen King. And it's about these toys that come to life and have to fight evil, basically. And that was... It wasn't like my nighttime story, but as I got a little bit older and graduated from stuff like Goodnight Moon, you know, that became my favorite. And so I've always been attracted to sort of like things that scare you as a kid, but also do so in a way that has a rewarding and happy ending. So I feel like this movie, I wanted to take it and sort of inject it back into my childhood movie experience, but I feel like that maybe not the right sort of framework for it. I think A24 is obviously aware. Probably a lot of the people that run that studio grew up with the kinds of movies that I'm talking about. And if they want to play their cards and start making PG kids movies that are still very much like creepy A24 movies in the process, then I'm all for it because I really enjoyed that genre when I was younger. And so I didn't love this movie like I would have loved it as a kid, but I felt the part of me that really enjoyed that element from my childhood sort of creeping up again.
There was a nostalgia comfort for you.
I guess, yeah, because it's like I'm not nostalgic for something that I haven't seen, but I guess I'm nostalgic for the feeling of seeing something that reminded me of growing up.
Yeah, I can see that. I think I was also kind of confused because this is a PG movie to me.
Jumanji? I'm sure you saw Jumanji, right?
Of course, but I wasn't a little kid for Jumanji.
I mean, we were 10, 11 years old. It was 1995.
Yeah, but that's what I'm about to say is like when I think of a PG movie, that to me means a kid of any age should be able to watch it, whether they understand the whole component or not, and be entertained. Where I feel like with this movie, this was kind of this kind of had a very target age demographic for a PG movie, where kids under a certain age, I don't think would have understood anything. They maybe would have enjoyed like the creature, but it was still a little scary with the noises and stuff. But I don't feel like this was a typical PG movie, because I don't think any kid could have watched this and been okay with it. It almost felt like this should have been PG-13 or like, yeah, maybe the 10 to 12 range. I don't know if younger kids could absorb this the same way.
I mean,
that makes sense.
Yeah, that's fair. The main character is a young girl who's probably like 13, maybe 12, you know.
Exactly.
You can tell that she's beginning to have some agency in life, and she's butting heads with her dad, and rightfully so, and she's butting heads with her brother a little bit, and I think there's a lot of world building here that's unfamiliar. So if you are a kid that's too young, there may just be cultural specifics that don't translate. Like, there's a lot of general storytelling in the beginning of this, of these beings and the relationship between the people and these beings and the mythology associated with that. And so for me, I feel like all that stuff is right at home in the dark fantasy universe. But for films that maybe were geared towards a little bit younger audiences, we'll say just like the Disney animated stuff that we grew up with, like, there's some adult stuff in there when you watch it as an adult, and you can kind of pick it out because now you're of the age to do so. But those are for the most part set in a world that also requires some storytelling. Like, if you think of, we'll use Snow White as an example since the live remake just happened, but it's like there's a world where there's dwarves and witches and magic mirrors, or Little Mermaid, there's sea creatures and Atlantis. So I feel like asking kids to buy into maybe those types of stories that they've already seen elsewhere, maybe before movies, like they may have already been in books or something. They may have already been represented on television before seeing those kinds of films, where with this, it does feel foreign in that way. Almost like How to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah. Well, and I also look at it, not that this is a big part of the movie, but like one of the first scenes we see of her and the creature is she's stealing a car and like trying to and driving it off, right?
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't get far because there's a flat tire or something, or the bolts are all coming off and it kind of like crashes. But would a 5, 6, 7, 8, anywhere up until like 10 or 11, 12 year old kid, like that would not be something I would want them to be like, oh, I could probably do that. You know what I mean? Like, that's where I feel like it's the older age kid genre of a PG movie, where like that is not something that's confusing. And like Little Mermaid, like they're not going to just jump in, try and become a mermaid, right? I mean, they're going to swim and have mermaid tails, but they're not going to just think they're going to be part of the underwater world.
I don't know. How old was our friend's daughter? How old is Nina?
5, maybe 6 this year.
When we saw her, you know, I told her that 5? I used to be a crab, and that I forgot what the story was, but I said that I was a crab person and that I got blessed and I was lucky, and then if I didn't do something, I'd get turned back into a crab. And she was like going along with it, like, oh, this is such a fun story. And then she stopped and looked at me and was like, wait, are you really a crab person? So I mean, yeah, at that age, I feel like she's smart enough to sort of understand the yarn that I'm spinning, but then also enough of a kid to be like, oh my god, like, are you a monster? Like, are monsters real?
Yeah.
So I don't know, with Disney movies though, you're not talking about stories about children. Like the Little Mermaid, like Ariel is 18, I assume, old enough to make a decision on who she wants to marry. Like, she's obviously the youngest daughter of the king, but we'll just say she's a rebellious older teen. Snow White as well, she's young, but I don't know how old. But these aren't like children. And the case of this film, this is actually a child. So maybe it is closer to home. I think in Neverending Story with Atreyu, like Atreyu's a kid too. So, you know, the childlike empress, I feel like Return to Oz, like Dorothy is significantly younger, whereas in the original Wizard of Oz, somehow she's basically an adult, not an adult, but you can tell that she's an adult human being in the film, even though she's playing a younger person. But then Firouzza Balk is maybe like 12 to 14 at the oldest when she's playing Dorothy in the second one. So I feel like movies featuring kids are okay to be like kids movies handling slightly bigger subjects.
No, I agree. I'm not saying that this is a fault or anything wrong necessarily with the movie. Again, I just feel like it being labeled as PG is not all encompassing of kids of all ages being able to watch it and absorb it and be like, oh, I love this as a kid movie, where I feel like this is more targeted to like the adolescent, early teen age range.
Yeah, I think tonally it's more of a PG-13 movie because right. it's dark and it's spooky and yeah, okay.
Yeah. That was my point, was that it was more, it felt more PG-13 than PG, because even like looking at Lilo and Stitch, right? That feels like a 4, 5, 6-year-old could see that movie, not maybe necessarily understand everything that's going on, but they're going to be probably entertained just because it's an easier, or maybe it's just more digestible, essentially. And in general, not to say it shouldn't stay away or should stay away from dark themes. I just felt like this was kind of mislabeled as PG. So I am curious to see A24 do more, but maybe other creative choices.
I mean, I don't know if this movie's going to make enough money for that to be a reality for the studio, but I'm glad they decided to do it. The Ochi, the little baby Ochi was cute.
He was very cute.
And I liked that they used a lot of real animatronics. They used a lot of old school filmmaking techniques, like some stop motion or pixelation, I think it's called.
Yeah,
there's kind of mixed media going on. So kind of a, just like a, like I said, it feels like a throwback to these particular types of films.
He kind of reminded me of a mix of a gremlin and a Furby.
Yeah.
So that was like a childhood nostalgia thing.
Yeah, like a little monkey that little sings. Monkey.
Little alien monkey.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so I was on board for it. I didn't even know it was PG until we sat down and actually figured out that that was what the movie was going to be.
Well, I told you it was a PG movie.
That's I know. I didn't know that Ochi was I see. Until I was just like, I don't know, poster. I see like a little creature. What? I'm in. Creatures. I do like creatures. Well, Ochi has a 6.3 IMDb, a 6.8 Metascore. It's Isaiah Saxon's first feature film. Made some music videos beforehand, so be curious to see him grow as a filmmaker and maybe do some more dark fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a go big or go home kind of moment, especially with the blend of the non-animation with What'd you say? Pixelation
is sort of like stop motion, I think, but not exactly stop motion. Yeah. They're in like the same family of techniques, but I think there was some like background matte paintings. So there's a lot of like different filmmaking techniques on display throughout the film that I appreciated.
Yeah.
So then we saw Sacramento.
Yes. Loved this movie.
So that was one that we were playing catch up from.
A couple weeks
had to be, but I mean, Michael Angarano was playing catch up for 10 years.
I mean,
trying
he's
to get
been
this
working.
Movie made. I'm aware, but he spent a lot of time,
yes,
and effort getting this movie made.
Yes, he spent, I think it was over 10 years on it. He wrote, produced, directed, and starred in it. His wife was in it. Michael Cera was in it. Kristen Stewart, who he has a long-term friendship with from previous projects, was in it. So it was nice to see like the passion project side of this. I mean, I'm a Michael Angarano fan, of course, in general, but I was excited for this movie because I know it's been a labor of love and it's been a long time coming, but also I like the pull at your heartstrings and like kind of comedy blend, but also dealing with life events kind of movies.
Yeah, this was good. I'm surprised. I just looked and I'm a little surprised it has a 5.9
really?
IMDb and a 69 Metascore, because it feels like the kind of quirky indie comedy that is generally well received, because it's going to be aimed at sort of a niche market anyway. And so I feel like the people that enjoy that sort of already are inclined to like this kind of film. And I think, you know, the comparisons between this and A Real Pain are maybe superficial, but I think rightfully applied, in that you have the director writing and starring in the film. It's about two friends. I mean, in Real Pain, they're cousins. So two people that like know each other, have a relationship, two very sort of polar opposite personality types. It's a road trip movie, I think, technically still, and that they're both going on an adventure somewhere. There is a recent death in the story that is a catalyst for the trip, and you sort of learn all of the prickly nooks and crannies of
grief.
The friendship at the same time, but also, yes, dealing with
grief,
yes, and so anxiety, panic, fear, a lot of different things. So one, I think, is more about, in A Real Pain, obviously, you know, you're talking about sort of like historical trauma passed down through generations and having to sort of relive that by putting yourself in that situation. And then, so it's a little bit more backwards focused, where this is a lot about the fear of the unknown, the anxiety of the future, you know, failing as a potential father.
Well, and I think it's interesting with this, too, because the movie is leading you to believe, or that's starting off, as that they're in different phases of their life, which technically they are, but we kind of quickly learn, well, not quickly, but we learn along the road trip, I guess you could say, that they're actually not in that different of a phase of life. And yeah, the mental health struggle component with Michael Cera especially was, I mean, he's always good. I feel like he's good at the quirky roles, but he played this really, really well. And I think with Michael Angarano having his own mental health struggles, and we kind of are, you know, we're let in on that a little bit in the beginning. There's some complicated grief relationships. And they're kind of on this journey together to heal in different ways, but also in the same way, and they just don't really know it entirely. Yeah, I mean, I love this movie. I think
it was really funny.
It was great. They were amazing together. They had great chemistry too.
They did. The guy next to us was tweaking though.
Creeper. I told you I hate those seats.
Yeah, I know. It's the two like love seat seats that we can book for ourselves, and then there's the one straggler on the end of the row, because it's seven seats across, not six, and so it always goes to someone that bothers you. And when we showed up, I mean, this is a complete aside from the movie itself, but an interesting sort of anecdote about the movie going experience and my general movie going experience, and why I go during the afternoon on a Tuesday or Wednesday when I can, because when we showed up, like, this guy was on his phone, he was reclined, seemingly normal, ignoring the trailers, just on his phone. And then the movie starts and he unreclines and sits forward as if he's playing a challenging video game. And then he starts like bobbing and weaving like he's dodging imaginary punches, and it's like super distracting, because unfortunately I was blessed with genetically good peripheral vision, so he's almost at 180 degree angle to my left and I can see everything he's doing, and it's like freaking me out. I'm like, what is going on here? And I mean, I just chalked it up to like, he's probably tweaked out.
I hate those seats.
Yeah. I mean,
I told you.
At least he wasn't on his phone, though. I'll give him that. He didn't talk, and he was not on his phone.
Yeah. Fair.
So bonus points to him for that, but it is tough. It's like, you know, one of the biggest conversations that is sort of happening online in terms of like film culture is what is happening to the sort of theatrical experience. Why don't people go to the movies anymore? And I think stuff like that is a big part of it because, you know, a lot of people just can't trust that they're going to go to the movies and have like a good movie going experience. You know, a guy, Kyle, who is like, he's in like the circle of like movie people I know online. He said that he didn't really enjoy Sinners that much, right? Like his initial rating was low and he's like, I might have to see it again. Then I saw that he mentioned that when he went to see it, like some lady walked in 40 minutes late and then like asked the entire audience, is this Sinners? And then there was kids on their phone the entire time. So he was having a bad experience, which affected his ability to view the movie. And, you know, I think there's certain theater etiquette stuff that goes a long way.
Absolutely. I feel like we've had that experience several times. I'm surprised you didn't notice when we saw Sinners, there was a girl in front of us doing the same thing.
Doing what?
But I think she was far enough. I think she was directly enough in front of you where it was only bothering me and you couldn't see it. She was literally on her phone texting the entire time.
Mm. And I saw it a little bit, but then like I moved enough to where like her phone wasn't lighting up my face. But yeah, so when we sit in the back, because I have good peripheral vision, I see everybody on their phone. And I'm like, I wish I worked at this movie theater so I could just come and take people's phones.
Yeah, I think honestly, I think it's a COVID thing because people just got so used to just like we've said it. People have full on conversations in the theater and it's like, hey, you're not on your living room couch.
Yeah.
Like, shut up. And it's sure, I think it ruins the experience a lot of time. And it definitely has skewed, I think, at least my experience of some movies. I know it definitely bothers you when you see it. Sometimes it doesn't bother me as much, like if they're quiet about it. But it's like, yeah, if you want to text and like post on social media, don't go to the movie theater. Like, that's not where you need to do that at. And I don't know what can be done to change it at this point. I honestly think there's no going back.
There isn't, just because people won't allow it. But so what you do is like the general public, I guess, who I would say is like not, they don't really care about like the integrity of the cinema in that way, right? Like you have purists who really believe that movies should be experienced in the theater. They go to the theater, like that is the place for that. And then there's people who like are a lot more casual moviegoers, casual movie watchers who are used to sort of being on their phone while watching something. And like streaming executives are like, yeah, we want a movie or a TV show that just when you push play, it's just on. And you're not really paying attention. We need stuff that people can watch while they're on their phones. And that's become like a design choice in the projects that are getting made for like at-home consumption. So then when there is a product that is now for the theaters that like the casual person is now interested in seeing, they bring that same behavior with them. And it's like, it's one thing if you lean over to your partner that you're watching the movie with and like you are whispering to each other. But it's another thing to like have like a full volume conversation and have like no consideration of the people around you. I think the same thing kind of with the cell phone. Like if you're going to be on your phone and you know you're an on your phone person, you shouldn't be sitting like in the front row of the movie where everybody's going to see you on your phone and like it's super distracting. Like go sit in the fucking corner.
Yeah, or turn down the brightness at least.
Some people do.
Most people don't.
I
mean, I am guilty of being that person, but I only do it at home and I only do it while I'm watching reality TV.
That's the kind of stuff that like.
But I'm just playing games. I'm not like posting on social media or whatever. Right. It's just like this is my decompression. I'm unplugging. I don't need to think about anything, but I don't translate that or I don't carry that with me into the theater or even when we go to see Broadway shows in the theater. It's like, put it away. Why are you here to see something live if you just want to be on a device all the time with a screen in front of your, like directly in front of your face? Honestly, I think that's why not to digress too much, but I think that's okay. Why we did not like Back to the Future, the musical.
Why?
Because of the distraction of the glitch in the beginning. And there were annoying people around us.
I just didn't think it was that good. I think the movie is too good to try to replicate in stage musical. Like, the movie is so iconic and so entrenched in the things that it does that it's very hard to try to come into the space to make a musical. But I felt like the musical was trying to parody Back to the Future more so than like be true to what the movie is. And so that for me was the issue more so than the glitch.
I mean, I agree with that part too, but I feel like it took me out of it right before it even like started or right as it was starting. So I don't feel like I gave any of it a chance.
Mm.
And the other stuff bothered me more potentially because I wasn't giving it a chance.
Yeah. I mean, it could just be that we're getting like old and crotchety. Finicky. Yeah. But at least when I see sometimes we'll see like four people come in as a group and like one person is on their phone because that person doesn't want to be there.
They've got FOMO.
Yes, but they're like socializing. And it's like, oh, we're all going to go see Sinners. And then that one girl's like, well, I don't care. I don't want to be here. So I'm just going to be on my phone the whole time.
Right.
And so like then that is ruining it for everybody else. And so like, you know, police your own party, I guess. Like put your phone away. But I do want to talk to Peter from Lumiere Cinema, who I've been in touch with, runs the theater in Beverly Hills, just about like running a theater and what it means and like what to expect. And so I might have some cool interviews lined up here for the show coming up pretty soon. Get back into the full like professional
interview process.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me too, especially like I enjoyed early on in the pandemic, like, great, we get to watch everything from the comfort of our couch and I get to stay in pajamas. But I still know how to be a decent human being when you take me in public to a movie theater. And I'm not going to take my phone out unless, like, it's an emergency, which is not usually happening anyways.
Yeah. Well, part of the reason that my preferred experience is to go to the movie theaters is because it makes me put my phone away and
adhere. Control issue. Self-control issue?
No, I think, you know, just being at home, like, you're more calm, or I'm more inclined to be like, oh, I recognize this person, let me check their IMDb kind of thing, right?
And yeah,
like see what else they've been in, like that. Like even if I think it at the movie theater, I'm not gonna do it because I have respect for the sanctity of the place. Like it's a communal place, we're all going to sit in the dark and experience the same thing, and I don't want to be the kind of person who like polices the way that other people experience art, right? But I do feel like there are things that are done in poor taste and without tact. And there was a story of like some kid or family like breaking something at a museum because they wanted a particular photo op of the kid like sitting on the sarcophagus and it smashed it or something. And it's like, yeah, so you shouldn't be doing that. Right. Because you're not respecting the thing that you're going to see. And so like you're not interacting with the art in any kind of meaningful way. But like, how do you actually sort of like just philosophically, like, do you want to engage in sort of controlling how other people are consumers of art, or that they should respect artwork in the same way that you do or have the same relationship? So I think like on the one hand, like, no, I shouldn't do that. But just I want, even if you don't have the same relationship, like just be respectful of the fact that I do have that relationship with it and like don't ruin the experience for people around you. I mean, before the movie starts, it's like get off your phone, turn your ringer off, don't talk. Like it gives you the ground rules, but the theaters don't enforce it because putting the burden of enforcing that kind of thing on some minimum wage kid that's like maybe 17 or 18 working their first job. And it's like, go deal with this Karen who's on her phone kind of thing. It's like, you don't pay them enough for that.
Well, not only that, you would need probably 4 to 6 people in every theater to police that.
Yeah. Well, this is why, like, I have a laser pointer, but you won't let me bring it and use it on people.
Because it's not safe, I don't feel like, these
That's
days.
The same reason that they don't confront them about the phones.
Exactly.
So Alamo Draft House is probably the place to go if you... They're very strict about their no phone policy.
Have we been there?
No, the closest one's in downtown, so we don't go.
All right.
But if we're ever downtown for some reason anyway...
Moving on.
It's all right. This is a show where we get to talk about, like, current sort of...
Go see Sacramento. It's worth it.
It definitely is. It's better than a 5.9 for sure. I laughed. It was funny. I know other people that liked it can vouch. And then we just saw it today. We saw Warfare, which is another one we're getting caught up on.
Heavy.
Brutal.
Anxiety provoking.
And we did not know that it was... based in 2006, but when we do the other show, Hers, His, and Ours, and we're covering Brothers and Sisters, there is a main storyline on that show that is talking about specifically the Iraq War during the 2006 timeline. And so seeing this movie, having just had this conversation with the episode about the soldier character's PTSD and him not wanting to go back to Iraq...
And getting called back.
And getting called back into active duty and then seeing this, I'm like, I totally understand why he doesn't want to go back.
Yeah. I mean, it was an interesting story because I feel like, you know, going into this, I kept hearing this was the most realistic war movie that had been made. And I do believe that. I mean, I can't remember every war movie necessarily off the top of my head. It did feel very realistic. It felt like we were... kind of in an observation deck with them watching this happen. I think for me, the only other thing that kind of came close to this was maybe Zero Dark 30.
Mm.
But kind of like close to the same timeline post 9/11, I'm pretty sure, because that was on, it was the capture of
Bin Laden,
right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Was it later on maybe? I don't remember.
I don't remember what year it came out, but
I don't remember either, but still very much, you know, sad and also heroic, of course, what these men and women go through, but even more sad around, like, the lack of resources that these war heroes have when they come back. And, you know, I think we had talked about on our other show that, you know, maybe PTSD wasn't as talked about for a long time, but I think it was, like, it's PTSD is not new,
it's
right?
It's not. It was called shell shock.
And it's just heartbreaking to me still that this is not paid more attention to, because even when you look at the faces of all of the people around, the people who are getting injured and, like, what they're witnessing, what you can tell they're in shock and, like, their nervous system is completely shot and they're pretty much going through the motions and maybe not even knowing what they're doing entirely. It's just, it's insane.
Well, we talked right after the movie and... I was mentioning to you that it's a very interesting follow-up for Alex Garland after doing Civil War to now pivot to this story, which is focusing on a very specific time in history where American troops are involved in a war that is not supported anymore. And what I was pointing out was that one of the interesting mechanisms in the story is that they introduce us to the characters as a team of Navy snipers that are there supporting Marine operations. And the Navy team is in this building and they're just kind of observing. But as they observe, more and more attention is coming to them. It's like their mere presence there initiates the conflict. And I don't think that's on accident by Alex Garland. Not at this point. And I think he co-wrote and directed with Ray Mendoza.
I'm pretty sure
he did. Yeah. So Mendoza produced, The Warfighters in 2017. It's a TV series. And I think Live to Tell is a war movie as well, or a series. No, it's a documentary. TV series. So, like, on the one hand, you have this focus on these soldiers who are doing their job as soldiers. They're actually not on screen here initiating any attacks against anybody, yet their presence in this area is just like slowly adding to this tension, and more people are becoming aware of where they are in this town. And as far as they show us, like, they're not there to actually do any harm. I think at one point he sees a guy with a gun. He says that he didn't take the shot, right? Couldn't do it. So they really just want to get in and get out and, like, not have any casualties on either side. And then,
or even conflict, really.
Yeah. Like, they're sort of doing everything very stealthily. They, you know, they move in the night, and then they just, like, have their positions and they're just observing. And then when shit hits the fan, like, it gets really bad, and you see that they're sort of, like, underprepared to be in the kind of conflict that they're in, and immediately are in over their heads. You know, they act heroically and they get their injured brethren out of there and got the other squad coming and rescuing them. There's, like, a huge firefight, and it is portrayed very realistically. And I just found it to be, there's been a discussion going on of, like, separating art from artists, and I don't think that that's, like, a realistic thing. And I think Alex Garland doesn't choose to get involved in making this film for no reason. I don't think the narrative that we see portrayed in the film is done haphazardly. I feel like this story is told in particular for a reason, right? And so the movie doesn't really end with kind of returning to base, and we don't get to see a lot of the post conflict stuff. This basically all takes place in one location throughout the course of, like, a day and a half, a couple days maybe. So it's not like a lot of other war movies where you're moving around a lot. You go back to the forward operating position and you talk to the commanders. Like, this is all just taking place inside this house for the most part. And I think that's intentional too, because when you pull away from that and then you go to, like, the decision makers who are not on the ground in that situation, it's sort of, it strips the narrative function of having this team of guys that are now cut off from air support. The ground support can't get there because of threats with IEDs. So all of a sudden, this group that we're with that seem very capable, well-armed, there's, I don't know, like, maybe 10 of them, I think, something like that. So they have, like, a fairly big crew. They take over this house. They don't, like, injure the residents inside. They subdue them and keep them quiet. They don't physically abuse them in any way. So it seems like they're very, like, workman-like professionals. And then to be like, hey, you're kind of on your own, I think that is saying a lot about the nature of that conflict that happened. Like, because already the war was losing support in 2006, to be like, hey, we want you to go provide support for this other operation that's happening. And then when you guys are taking mass casualties, oops.
Hang on, we'll be there eventually.
Yeah. I mean, they outright told them no, and they had to fake it, right? They had to have the guy call in on the radio and fake in orders, because they're like, no, we need to get the hell out of here. So they're very aware of their situation, and there were some really bad injuries, and I think the movie was dedicated to Elliot, who survived.
Yeah, he was part of the filmmaking.
He was.
But what happened to Sam then?
I think he survived too. Okay. I think they showed his picture later.
Okay. Yeah, I thought it was interesting to see. Well, I'm glad. It seemed like he was very dedicated to the authenticity, which I think also doesn't necessarily happen all the time with these movies. But we see at the end, they have real military showing them how to make those movements.
Yeah.
Couple of the, you know, there's a lot of people whose faces were blurred. I don't blame them whatsoever, mm-hmm. especially if they're still active, who knows, but you know, to see the intention behind whether it was Alex Garland or the other, what was his name?
Ray Mendoza.
Ray Mendoza's, or both of them combined, just being very intentional around the authenticity of, like, we're telling this story. This is a real story. These are real people's stories. And I thought it was also interesting. This was all done based on memories. And that also makes me think, like, was this not documented or something? Like, what? Obviously, of course, using the people involved, of course, this can be based on their memories, but do we know how much is documented or not documented in these kind of situations during a war? I don't know.
Well, I think that, again, speaks to the, like, intentional nature of this particular story.
Right.
Because if you tell this story from sort of, like, the military's perspective more broadly, this maybe gets told a little bit differently, right? Versus we're taking the memories and the accounts of the guys that were in it.
Right.
And that's the script that we're going to write, because you see that they're afraid. Like, you see a lot of them are afraid and in shock and not really knowing what to do, and that there is conflict sort of within the group. You have the leader, played by Will Poulter, who's having a very good year. He's got another movie coming out this weekend. You see that he's like, I'm fucked up. Yeah. Like, you have to take command right now, because he's like, he got like his bell rung from the Claymore explosion, and then there's another explosion, and he's out of it, and he's not in a position to lead. So you see even the guy who was our leader, like, panicking, saying he doesn't know what to do. You see some of the other guys, the medic is injured, and he's, you know, trying, other guys who aren't the medic are, like, trying to help him. So I think you see a lot of fear portrayed here, where a lot of the time the portrayals are much more ruggedly heroic. I don't know if you've ever seen it's the Peter Berg movie with Mark Wahlberg and Ben Foster and Emile Hirsch, and
he was a sniper, right?
I don't know if they were snipers, but they all sort of, like, took fire, and I've seen it a couple times. I don't know why I can't remember the name of it, but that movie just shows, like, how tough these soldiers are, and they are tough for sure. But I think the sort of framework of that film is focused on sort of glorifying the toughness of the soldiers, and this is, I think, praising their heroic actions while also being very careful to, like, say that these are vulnerable human beings at the same time.
Yeah, it humanizes them.
Yeah. Lone Survivor is the name of that movie,
Yes. Yeah. I did see that one.
Yeah, it's good.
It's been a while, but yes, I did see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I agree, and I think, like, that's part of the stigma around veterans in general, or anyone who's been in these kind of combat zones, of that, you know, like, we see one of the characters be like, you got this, buddy, you got this, and he's, like, trying to hype him up, and the other guy's like, dude, stop, like, that's not what he needs right now.
Yeah. And
I think that it's probably a survival tactic for them mentally, of course, but it is still nice to see, like, hey, they are still human, they're sacrificing a lot. It's okay that they're shooken up, or that they've got feelings about this, or that this is disturbing. Like, this is awful to witness and be a part of, or even be in the middle of. Like, let that be okay that it's bothering them.
Yeah, there's, like, a lot of focus of just paying attention to, like, where you're putting your feet in the middle of sort of a very fragile and bloody mess, right?
Yeah, I mean, especially with, like, not to get into too many details, but, like, post-explosion with the people in the street kind of a thing, and just, like, paying attention to, you know, I think especially, like, you always hear some of the worst fears of loved ones, right? Or what I thought he was, one of the reasons why he was dragging one of them back inside is that there's always this fear around not getting to have the closure of like having the lost one come home, per se. And I mean, this portrays how very realistic that is, too.
Yeah, it is very graphic at moments. It's not, I guess, as graphic as I think I'd imagined based on some people's reactions, but it is gnarly in some moments, and it feels real when you're there watching
it. My heart rate was up for sure.
It definitely does a good job of like pacing and sort of building that anticipation, because it like nothing happens for like half an hour. They're just kind of like watching, and then all of a sudden like shit hits the fan. It's a firefight for the last hour or so.
But I think that feeds into the realism.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Like most of the time you're not doing anything, but then when you are, it's like you go from calm, relaxed, just doing your job to like, oh, I have to fight for my life. It's a very
literally. Yeah.
Very, very different mentality to have, and I think that's it's handled well in the film, from at least what I can see. But that was the last of the ones that we saw. I saw Woman in the Yard by myself, The Woman in the Yard. I liked a lot of elements of it. I don't know that I loved it. I don't know that I thought it was like exceptional, but there's definitely a lot of things that I liked about it. I feel like Danielle Deadwyler was good. I feel like the dynamic of the family that is presented was interesting. There's a tragedy that occurs in the family, and as a result, mom is injured and depressed, and her kids, especially her son, is maybe like a 15-year-old, so he's starting to like come of age and have some pushback with mom, and then the power goes out, and then this hooded figure shows up in the yard, and why that figure is there starts to unravel all the things that we don't know about that story. And there's some like very good horror filmmaking techniques. I don't know if I would ever say that I was like outright like scared, but it does things, I would say, sort of mechanically the right way for this type of film to build the kind of momentum into horror moments. And, you know, had I seen this maybe when I was younger, it would have been a little bit more effective with some of the horror stuff that it chooses to do. But I feel like the story is a lot more of like an emotionally personal drama than it is a horror movie. And the horror movie is maybe just like the hook that draws you in, because it feels like a ghost story, but maybe not necessarily horror. Definitely like supernatural, right? But right here, even it says supernatural horror and teen drama. I wouldn't say it's like
teen drama.
Yeah, teen drama and teen horror seem like weird descriptors to put on that. But it's got a very small cast. It has a 51 Metascore and a 5.1 IMDb, so not super well liked. This headline says, scary but boring with a frustratingly nonsensical plot. I feel like the plot actually, for the most part, makes sense until the supernatural elements get there. And so I had to step back and think of the movie after the fact, as this is all about this woman dealing with sort of grief and guilt, and that really being this thing that's haunting her and her family. And if I look at it through that lens, I feel like that works. But then introducing like a actual physical ghost and getting into a little bit of the more supernatural stuff later in the movie maybe undermines the emotional work that the rest of the film has succeeded in. But you still get good performances. It's not super long either, so it's worth a watch, I think, especially if you generally tend to like horror movies.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Well, On Deck, you know, Accountant 2 came out.
Did we see the first one?
I've seen the first one, yeah.
Did I see it?
I don't know.
I don't know either. I'm sure I did.
Ben Affleck doing math, killing folks, I think.
Probably, yeah.
I don't remember the details exactly, but...
Is there a scene where he's in, like, a booth or something at the airport?
Maybe.
Then, yeah, I've seen it.
Okay. I cannot confirm nor deny. I don't know. The Accountant 1 was not the kind of movie where I ever would have thought there'd be an Accountant 2 coming after it. But
Brento's in it.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, they're holding guns on the cover. They're going to shoot some shit. Not super appealing to me, but I'll watch it if I've burned my other options. I want to see The Shrouds, though, which is Cronenberg's latest, and Vincent Cassell is the lead, and it's like there's a camera in people's graves, and then you kind of like go into a machine and you can either sort of look at them or hang out with them. I don't know. I don't want to know too much, right? But I just like saw the trailer and there's like tombstones with cameras and there's like a device that you sit in, and I trust Cronenberg to do weird stuff, because even though at first I didn't love the one that he did with Viggo most recently, where he eats plastic and that's like the thing of the future, Crimes of the Future. Thank you. That one, I didn't necessarily like it at first so much, but the further away that I've gotten from it, the more I feel like I appreciate what that movie was doing. And so maybe he's just a little bit ahead of the curve in that way. We've got Revenge of the Sith, Star Wars Episode 3 re-releasing, I think, for the 25th anniversary.
Oh, wow.
20th anniversary. I don't know. Of the original prequel series, I shouldn't say original, but of the prequels, 1, 2, and 3, I feel like Revenge of the Sith is my favorite, because we get the great lightsaber fight between Obi-Wan and Anakin down in the weird lava pits. It's the one where Obi-Wan fucks him up, and he sort of becomes Darth Vader as a result. Anakin goes crazy and kills a bunch of kids, I think, when he finally like turns to the dark side. So I like that one. I have a fondness for those, even though I think at the time it was easy to recognize that they were not like stupendous. I think as kids growing up as Star Wars fans, we're watching movies from the 70s and 80s. And then when they're making ones for us and our generation as Star Wars fans, it's like, hey, this is great.
Yeah.
And so maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But there's that one scene that I love. And I do love Ewan McGregor's portrayal of Obi-Wan throughout the series. So I would probably go watch that if I have time. Tom Hardy is starring in Havoc on Netflix, which is Gareth Evans, who directed the Raid films. So bloody, violent, fast-paced action. So that'll be fun. And then Until Dawn, that weird sort of time loop horror movie where they're like, you got to survive until the morning or else you're just stuck in this time loop of getting killed by different sort of like ghosts and monsters again. Could be good. Maybe not. Those are like the main players. And then April, California King, Neighborhood Watch, and then On Swift Horses comes out. Those are all probably going to be limited release or very hard to find. But Will Poulter is in On Swift Horses. So that's his third movie already this year, with Death of a Unicorn. And
this was a major redemption
for Will.
For Will.
I mean, I thought he was good in Death of a Unicorn. I know you didn't like that movie, but
no.
Okay. So we got some stuff to watch. We still got to catch up on things from the last couple of weeks as well. So
yeah, we still got to finish White Lotus.
We only got one left. We'll do that. We'll talk about TV shows on the other show.
Okay.
And then we'll reconvene, hopefully, with some more movies under our belt in a week. You can watch Havoc at home.
Cool.
You can play on your phone while I watch Tom Hardy brutalize people.
Cool.
Cool, cool.
Cool, cool.
All right. Well, thanks for sticking with us. Thanks for listening. I need to maybe change the release schedule for the show to like semi-weekly, because we try to do it every week, but sometimes it's like, we saw one movie.
Might as well save it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Let's just release it when we see a good amount of movies and not be... Yeah.
No pressure.
Yeah, not be strict on a schedule for this one.
Yeah. Sounds good to me.
All right, cool.
All right, take care, everybody.
Bye.
Alrighty, Roo. Thank you for tuning back in and for taking the time to listen to this episode. I used to say you were stuck with us doing this until we figured out that other project that we were working on, but we figured it out. So if you enjoy hanging out with us, then make sure to check out Hers, His, and Ours, H-O-U-R-S. That is our new television-based show where Kristen and I will be sharing favorite TV shows that the other one of us has not seen, and then the two of us will share with the audience a TV show that we both love. And we also do This Week on the Couch, where we just talk about stuff that we watched on TV. You can find that and all the other shows in the Scheist Podcast Network by looking for Scheist Pod Net on Instagram, Blue Sky, and Twitter. And until next time, take care, everybody.